ready to make fashion fireworks? Right now at Old Navy, get up to 60% off the entire store during Old Navy's Red, White, and New Sale. Save big with items for $2, $4, $6, and $8, including women's tanks for just $2. And up to 60% off summer essentials like flip-flops, tank tops, swimwear, and shorts. Get more bang for your buck with up to 60% off your favorite all-American styles right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Select styles only. Entire store offer valid 6/28 to 7/5. Excludes clearance, gift cards, register lane items, jewelry, today only deals, today only deals.
Blog Talk Radio.
This is Charles Mudd on Gaming Chords. I appreciate you joining us to listen. And today, I am very excited to have JC Salinas with us. JC, how are you?
Doing great, man. How are you doing?
Good. So, you and I came into contact through MineCon last year, MineCon 2016, that was held in Anaheim, and you were in the indie development section where they had a number of independent game developers showing their wares, and you happened to be showing what we heard came back to me as well as being a very cool and exciting game. And why don't you tell us a little bit about the game, and then I want to find out a little bit more about you. But what was the game that you were showing or exhibiting at MineCon last year?
Sure. So the name of the game is a Dual Hand Disaster Tracker. It is a split-screen, single-player twin-stick risk-em-up where your score is meaningless unless you exist. Basically, what that means is you're supposed to get a high score like basically any other arcade-type game that's based on high scores. The only thing is, the only way for you to keep your score is to decide when to leave with it. So you can't just play till death like you normally would. You have to decide when to leave with it. So it's a lot about gambling, pretty much.
Yeah, right. That definitely came across there as you were describing it, that it's knowing when to walk away, right? Knowing when to take your winnings, so to speak, and move on. Now, has the game launched live yet and available for the public, or are you still going through testing?
No, yeah, I'm still testing and still kind of putting some finishing touches on the design. I'm definitely at the tail end of it, but it is still like, you know, basically cleaning up a lot of code and tying up a lot of loose ends that I've been trying to fix throughout the couple of months I've been showing it at events. Like, I've been taking it to events, and that's where I get most of my feedback.
Well, and you know, I think that that's interesting for the listeners, too, to understand that, you know, there may be this perception of those playing the game, or the perception of those in the consumer public generally, that game development can happen overnight. And obviously that's not the case. So when did the inception of this particular product, this particular game, how long have you actually been working on it?
I started working on it when I dropped out of college for game design, ironically. I guess 2013. You also have to remember, I didn't have any programming experience whatsoever. I basically went to school to try and learn how to make video games, but that was a complete waste of time, so I just dropped out. and just started working on it from there. And I had to learn how to use the game engine that I was making the game in also. So that, I think, took up a bigger chunk of time than actually coming up with a design and implementing the mechanics that I have. So I had to learn Unity for alongside making the game, but I think that took more of my time because I had to get familiar with the UI and everything. But I started on the design back in like 2013.
All right. Now, I want to hit on a couple points there because certainly we don't want to advocate to everyone that dropping out of school is the way to necessarily do things and build a career path, particularly
Absolutely. For
my two
yeah.
kids if they're listening. But it's interesting that you say that you went to school for game design
right.
and you were not getting the education that you were seeking. Now, why do you – let's take a moment on that, and why do you think that was?
I think probably mostly because of the way that I work, and it is definitely just my decision. Of course, like you said, it's not advice for people to drop out of school and do what I did. It's mostly because the way the program itself, the online courses were structured, they didn't teach me a damn thing about how to make a video game. It was, you know, like one of my first classes was, hey, do you know how to install Word on your computer? Which seems like a complete waste of time. You know, one of the other classes was like, hey, do you know how to review a video game? Let's review a video game. And stuff like that. Like, yeah, they tangentially, I guess, relate to the video game industry, but they weren't teaching me what I wanted to learn. I wanted to get my hands into, you know, I wanted the tools. I wanted to be able to learn how to use the tools and then just leave me to my devices, you know, like, let me just figure this out. But teach me the tools, and then I'll create the product, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, it does. And so you weren't getting that in school. And were those online classes, or were those actually in the classroom with an instructor?
No. Yeah, no, it was all online classes with instructors. But I think that's the thing, right, is it's instructors. It's not really teachers or professors or any kind of, like, people who have, I don't know if this sounds negative, but, like, a legitimate position to be teaching you something. It was more instructors. It was just people that kind of, like, instruct you on doing things. I don't know if that makes sense, but it didn't feel like I was learning anything. Like,
yeah, I would certainly agree that there's there are people that know how to do certain things, and then there are those who can actually teach how to do those
yes.
same things. And yeah. the two skills are not necessarily coexisting in everybody. I think that teaching certainly is a skill. So you leave,
yeah.
you start learning on your own. And I'm sure
right.
that had its difficulties and advantages. But before we get to that,
sure.
let's dispel another myth for those out there. My understanding is that this is also not your full-time job. You do have a daytime job or another aspect of your life that helps pay the bills and so forth. Is that correct, or are you a full-time rogue game developer?
No, yeah, 100%. I have a day job. And one of the reasons why is it's one of those things that I always get questions about, right? It's like, how do you get funding to start making a video game? And I always tell them, is like, the best way to get funding is get a job. You know, like, the least amount of money you can borrow from someone, like, obviously I have credit cards and stuff like that also, but it's one of those things, right? It's like, the least that you can ask someone for money, the more control you have in what you're doing. If you're
right.
asking for funding right off the bat, then you probably don't have a good design to begin with. Like, you need to have – it's kind of a way to have more control over what you're doing. And it's not control just for control's sake. because obviously you do want to get funding and it does help and stuff like that, but you want to be able to fund as much of it as possible so that you don't owe anybody in whatever terms you want to put that in, but you don't want to owe anybody anything before you've even started working on something, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
It does. Now, and has that been successful? I mean, have you been able to minimize obligations or loans or owing, as you said, third parties, then by having that job? So have you been able to sufficiently self-fund at this point?
Yeah, enough to where, like I said, like I've been able to work on the game and go out to events and stuff like that and show the game and get feedback. Granted, I don't like it. What I basically did is I applied my way of thinking. When I'm primarily a musician, so I always think about touring and getting out on the road to promote your music, right? It's kind of the same idea that I do with the video game stuff is I take the game to events so I can show it to a wide swath of people that I normally wouldn't if I was just sitting at home, you know, talking about the game on forums or something. It's worked out perfectly fine. Just like I was able to meet you at these events, you know, and that led to this interview. So it's staying on the road and meeting people that you normally wouldn't, but you have to get off your ass to kind of do that.
And I think that, you know, you hit on a point that you and I had previously discussed, and that is that, you know, looking, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the same thing
right.
for, you know, my day job and so forth as well, is if you go to a conference, if you go to an exhibition and you have a booth or you're doing something, if you look at it solely in terms of, did I get a new client from the conference, or did I, you know, does somebody want to distribute my video game, or did somebody come up and give me $50,000? If you look at it solely in those terms, I believe that many people are missing the intrinsic value of those events because, as you suggested, you know, the value may come from unexpected places. You may meet somebody. You may come across somebody that leads to something else or leads to another opportunity that, like, for example, you're talking on our program Gaming Chords, and if somebody out there listens and contacts you, then that's great. And that would not have occurred but for you having been at MindCon 2016 in Anaheim. And I guess it was... you know, the Wiff Fox, and certainly I've perused that area of the indie game development. You actually, my oldest son came up to you, right? And
right.
Being the young entrepreneur, I guess, in himself. but how was that? How do you get the reaction? Like, when you go to MindCon, when you go to these events, what kind of reaction do you get? What do you value coming out of those events?
Honestly, just talking to the people that are playing the game more than anything. And it's just like, even it's not so much having a direct feedback connection, right? Like someone doesn't have to tell me, hey, I don't like this part of your game, or, hey, this part's really awesome. Like me personally, just watching them play the game is enough for me to get something out of it. And that to me is more valuable than someone showing up and saying, hey, you know, we'd really like to publish your game on blah, 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 or whatever. Like, the thing is,
well,
I'm working on the game
example,
here.
Like,
yeah.
Can you give me an example or two where you are watching people play the game and you obtain something from that?
Yeah, so the perfect example is actually something I learned from doing the Indie Mega Booth at GDC just this past March, is you have this continuous, again, swath of people that are just coming back, right? They'll play the game, and you'll instantly know that they're not getting something that's being shown explicitly on the screen. For example, one of the very first instructions you get in the game is hold the left trigger to shoot. And you kind of start to count in your head the amount of people that instantly get that, and the amount of people that just kind of don't, and then they look at you and they're just kind of like tapping the controller and they're like, what am I doing wrong? And you realize that they're not paying attention to what you're telling them on the screen, but at the same time, I can realize that, okay, well, maybe what happens is I'm not making it that obvious that you need to hold that button. And they didn't have to tell me that. I just got to see, you know, based on their input and their connection with the game, whether they were holding the trigger or not, whether they were looking at that side of the screen or not. Because one of the things, obviously, is that the game is split into two screens. So I need to know what someone is paying attention to. And if something happens on the right side, you're not looking at what's happening on the left side.
So why is the screen split into why is the game split into two screens? Can you go into that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So the whole purpose of the game is that on the left-hand side, you're basically destroying enemies and earning your points. So to generalize it, basically, it's like you're playing Galaga or Space Invaders on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side, you're playing Pac-Man. So you're like avoiding obstacles and capturing your power pellets. Essentially, that's what your resources are. So on the left-hand side, you're earning your points. On the right-hand side, you're recovering resources that multiply those points. So the whole purpose of the game is to split your attention into two separate things to see how well you can focus on doing one or the other. But on the left-hand side, your stress is kind of relieved because you're not concerned with taking damage. The right side is the only side that can take damage. So on the left-hand side, I just want you to be aggressive and kill some enemies, while on the right-hand side, you're kind of like just casually moving around, trying to focus on recovering resources that help you on the left-hand side also.
And was that a design feature from the very beginning that you were thinking of, the core concept?
Yeah, so from the very beginning, like, you know, faced with a completely blank screen, all I did was just pick up a controller, and I tried to imagine, like, what would I want to see on the screen? What would be interesting to me and fun to do? And then I started to think of splitting the controller in two, and then when I thought of that, I just thought of these other games that I like to play that do similar things where you're controlling two characters at the same time. The only thing is, the issue I would find with those games is, for example, Brothers is a good example. In Brothers, you're controlling two brothers at the same time, one on the left stick, one on the right stick, and your only interaction button is the triggers. So you have your left and right trigger. Each trigger corresponds to each brother, of course. The only thing is, in Brothers, they are on the same screen. They're on the same, 3D space. So when each character crosses the center of the screen, you kind of lose control of who you're controlling. You lose focus on who you're controlling, and it gets frustrating when you're trying to solve a puzzle because you think you're controlling one brother, but it's actually the other brother, and you end up failing the puzzle because of that. And that gets really frustrating because it doesn't feel like it's your fault. It's more a fault of the design, the way the game was designed. So my thing was, the way to solve, quote-unquote, that problem was to basically split the screen in half and give you two distinct things to do. So now your attention is completely like, I'm controlling this side or I'm controlling this side. And the game does get hectic, but it only gets as hectic as you allow the game to get, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
What platforms, let me jump to another topic really mm-hmm. quick or aspect, and what platforms will your game be developed for? Like, will you be a cross-platform, or are you focusing on one platform
yeah.
right now?
Well, I'm going to release on Xbox One, PS4, and Steam. Primarily I'm focusing on Steam right now, or the PC version, just because it's a lot easier to kind of, you know, implement stuff really quick, without having to push to like a dev kit, which it doesn't slow down time too much because my game's not huge, but it does help with the, iteration. So I can kind of implement something real quick, make a build, or even just test within the editor, make sure it works, and then just keep going from there. And then once my idea or whatever mechanic I was working on is kind of, you know, finalized, for lack of a better term, I push it to the dev kit just to make sure, you know, Xbox One or PS4, just to make sure that nothing broke. For example, like a texture didn't break or an input mechanism isn't functioning on this particular console or whatever. But in terms of releasing the actual game, I do plan on releasing on all three at the same time. Only time will tell if anything else comes up that will, you know, maybe hinder that. But if anything, Steam would be definitely the first release, simply for the idea of everything is a lot easier to make on PC than it is to push to other consoles. Because obviously consoles also have their own requirements in terms of friends lists and all that kind of stuff. So.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, and I am looking forward to it being released, whether it's Steam, we have Xbox One, you know, what have you. But I want to, as you were describing, you know, 2013 is kind of when I believe you started taking the classes, you weren't necessarily happy. And so 4 years later, more or less, you've educated yourself, and
mm-hmm.
you really, obviously, you're developing a game, you're getting to the milestone and so forth of production and release. What do you think that was, in hindsight, do you think that you learned more by doing it yourself in that way than you would have from that school? And then, you know, we obviously have already mentioned the other aspect that there might be professors, there might be teachers in the true sense of the word out there that can do a better job. But how do you, I guess another way of asking this question is, how do you view the education that you've received yourself over the last 4 years? Because it sounds like not only was there the programming, but the business aspects, the design aspects, you learned a lot, I imagine.
Oh, yeah, 100,000 billion percent for sure. And I think I have learned a lot more on my own, just kind of throwing myself into it as opposed to anything I would have learned at school, because I gave school a year. I gave the university a year of my time and patience to see if there was anything that I actually learned from it. And there wasn't a single thing that I got from school that I've applied to what I'm doing now. Everything that I've done or have accomplished on my own has been from applying to events, from going out to these events and meeting other indie developers and learning from them and stuff like that. So yeah, it's mostly been from you know, just. And also making friends that have taught me things, right? But that also came from me going out and meeting these people, not from anything I learned from school. Like, school didn't teach me, hey, you know, make friends with this particular developer because they know how Unity implements this particular feature. That came from me just asking a question.
Right. So let me ask you, talking about that and flipping the tables now, for those young individuals out there or older individuals that are wanting to develop their own game,
mm-hmm.
let's take it outside of whether university or, you know, homeschooling or self-schooling or what have you. Just let's talk generally. What do you think for somebody that is wanting to develop their own game? What are some of the key things that they should be learning, or where do they start in doing that?
Basically, the first thing to do is ask a question. So, and the first person you could ask is yourself. Like, basically how I did is, like, how do I make a video game? Well, just by playing video games, I knew about people that play video games, so you naturally find out about engines like Unity or GameMaker. So that was my first step. Well, I want to learn how to use Unity. So actually, I started on GameMaker. So GameMaker is a good way to do it. So you start up GameMaker. You don't know how to use it. So you ask another question. Well, how do I do this? It's 2017. You have the internet. You use Google. You type in your question. You'll get thousands of questions that people have asked that are similar to yours. You click on a link and you just follow it. And you just you have to have that natural desire in you to want to learn. There are a lot of people that, you know, will ask a question of like, well, how do I make a video game? But in reality, their intent is more, you know, like, well, make the video game for me, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like, they don't have they don't have the desire to actually want to learn. They just want to find ways around the hard parts. And it's not easy, you know, making a video game is not easy. And I don't want people to think that. It's really, really difficult. You just need to apply yourself to it, as with anything else, you know, like you just need to apply yourself to doing what you want to do and ask questions. Like, that is the most important part. Without asking questions, you're never going to get anywhere.
Well, on that note, we will open the lines up to questions if there are any, if anybody's calling
in.
And we have our producer, Lindsay, who will pop in if we do have somebody waiting with a question. But
of course.
So I invite any listeners wanting to talk to JC, wanting to ask those questions that he's asked about or talked about, feel free to call. And or you can also, if you're listening live, you can also text messages as well through the Blog Talk Radio program. So where do you see the next 6 to 12 months for you? What is in store moving forward? I know that you and I had conversations about different programs that you were applying for, for game developers and so forth. Where do you see the next 6 to 12 months for JC, for yourself?
Definitely releasing the game, that's for sure. I did make 2017 my year to release, and I made a couple of difficult decisions that led to that, but I feel 100% justified in doing those for, you know, to finally get the game out. Definitely... one of the biggest decisions was basically to when I started making the game, I really wanted to have Twitch interaction, which is I don't know how familiar you are with this, Charles, but it's basically where, you know, if people aren't familiar with it, is, you know, Twitch integration is when someone can basically watch someone play the game and then be able to, you know, hashtag the game with commands and stuff like that. And that's something that I wanted to do from the very beginning. But again, like I said, I'm not a programmer. So that was a little more than I could actually pull off on my own. But I did get to see based on how people were reacting to the mode, because I had the mode in the game. It just wasn't proper Twitch interaction. So it was just like a couple of debugs that I was able to send to the game that implemented what would happen if someone was watching you play the game. And when I got to show that to people, their faces just lit up. Like, it was just like, holy crap, how are you able to do this? Like, how are people able to even, play the game this way? It's so intense. Like, to give you some context, is when you play this particular mode, the game will swap the screen. So now your right is on your left. It'll invert your control. So up is down, down is up. And however, if you're able to survive those different modes of the game or whatever, you get bonuses for it, mad bonuses. So your scores are multiplied, a lot more than just the normal game is. So it's a lot more exciting. It's a lot more challenging. And there are people that, you know, there are people that get scared. Like, they're just like, holy crap, I can't do that. But there are also people that just really, really love it. They love the idea of, like, their concentration is really, really pushed. So that was one of the modes that I wanted to have in the game. So my decision was, since I can't pull off the Twitch integration of it, I basically just made it a mode, a tier, basically, in the game. So the game revolves around three tiers. The first tier is the basic one. The second tier is the second challenge. The third tier is basically that Twitch integration mode, which messes with your game and stuff. So it's just a standard part of the game now. And by removing that, I'm able to focus on just finishing the game now, which is just polishing it, making sure some of the visuals are done. More than anything, game over screen and animating it and making it a little more interesting. A lot of that stuff was all placeholder, which I'm glad not too many people, you know, were disappointed with the way that kind of was in the game when they would see it. But I hope that once they see the final version of how I implement the game over screen and all that kind of stuff, like, it'll pay off in the end. But yeah, stuff like that. Like, that was one of the biggest ones, is removing that part of the programming that I know I wasn't going to be able to pull off. And just focusing on polishing and finishing the game.
Yeah. Well, 2017, it sounds good for that release. And, you know, as I was listening to you talking about adding features and so forth, deciding to modify the Twitch implementation into just a different game, did you ever think about, and circling back to funding, did you ever think about crowdfunding aspects for the game, or you know, any kind of efforts like that to obtain funding?
I have applied for funding, like with there's a program in the indie community called Indie Fund. I've applied for funding, but I've never looked for crowdfunding because crowdfunding, nobody knows who I am. And to try and garner up like this huge, the amount of money that I would need to finish the game or even to just keep working on the game was definitely more than I knew I could raise. And to me, again, that was why I have my job. My job will pay for that kind of stuff. I also don't want to ask people for money without being able to give them a product in return.
Interesting. Just as an aside, JC, is that, you know, that, and even though the presumption is like on Kickstarter, you know, you're putting money in, you may or may not get something in return. That's
right.
That's a sophisticated knowledge of that platform. But yet there are many people who contribute and provide money on Kickstarter and are disappointed when there is no product or when the development fails, or it turns out that they don't release the product, or they don't release the film, and you're not buying something through that. You're contributing to the possibility, right? You're contributing to a possibility.
Yeah.
Related on another note, though, so let's say that you release that. How are you going to see that? Is that one that you will come back and update and add more content, or is it putting to bed the baby and moving on to another project that you may have in mind?
That one's actually kind of tough because – yeah, exactly. Because I do – I mean, I don't know if we even mentioned this at the beginning, but I am the only developer on this game. I'm a one-man developer from El Paso, Texas, so – it does make it a little more difficult for me to actually be like, oh, you know, like, let's move on to this new project, but I still kind of want to work on this also. So I'll take it as, you know, once I release the game, I do have a lot more ideas that I still would love to add to this game. But there's also that thing of feature creep that would have kept me from releasing this game if I just kept adding onto it. So I gave myself a set design stop point, if that makes sense, to just get the game to a point where I could release it. But I definitely have two or three more like features that I would like to add on top of obviously the Twitch integration, which I still really want to implement. But it would keep me from releasing the game sooner rather than later, right? It is something I do have in the back of my head where I want to keep supporting this game and adding to it with updates, because DLC and all that stuff is obviously possible, and I would love to do that. But I also do have like two or three other ideas that I'd like to maybe start on. But one of the things I do need to stress 100%, even if people are listening and they want to work on a game, is you have to have scope. So if you don't have scope, you don't have a set determination of what the game's going to be, then you're just going to keep working on it forever, which can be good or bad. It depends on your point of view, right? But that was my decision. Like, I gave myself a set point of finishing so that I could get the game done, and then I could always explore the DLC stuff later.
Right. Well, I think that scope is a really good point that you mentioned, and it's not only in game development, it's in nearly everything. I mean, I remember stories of some of my friends and colleagues working on their dissertation, and you can always find the next footnote, right, or the next resource, because as you're writing, other people are writing, there's always going to be something coming out, and at some point you have to have that finite plan and release. And with the dissertation, I guess you publish it and it's done. But here, it's really good to hear, JC, that once it does come out and people are able to purchase it for Steam, Xbox, what have you, that there may be more down the road and that you're providing support for and so forth. So when, for those listening,
right.
When is there a target, could we say before December, or is there a more fixed target in 2017 you might have?
No, not yet. One of the big events I'm looking at is I'm hoping to hear back from the Indie Mega Booths for PAX West. And that is one of the targets that I kind of set for myself. Like, if I get selected for the Mega Booth, I really want that day to be the day that I release. And I'll move, like, you know, I'll move everything out of the way just to get that date done. But outside of that, like, it's more like, okay, then I can just take a little bit more of my time and release, you know, again, like you said, sometime before December. But I would like
right.
it to be, yeah, PAX West. But, yeah, that's kind of all up in the air.
Now, PAX West, when is that again?
PAX West is September 1st through the 4th, if I remember correctly.
And what are some of the more valuables? I'm not going to ask you to pick, you know, one, but what are some of the more valuable or beneficial events that you've been to or more rewarding? What are some of the events that you've left and you've said, wow, I would definitely recommend to anybody that's developing a game, or I guess even somebody who likes games, that they should be there?
100,000%, I would say PAX. Any of the PAXes, PAX West, South, East, either of them. Those, without a doubt, those are obviously, because those are the most known, right? So there's going to be a lot more presence in terms of, like, anything from, like, big-name developers all the way down to, like, you know, dumbasses like me that are just, like, working on a game in their spare time or whatever. But then you also have other events like TwitchCon and MineCon, of course. Personally, to me, like, MineCon was actually really cool just because it was the first event that where I was able to have, you know, young kids play the game, where for the most part, like, at PAX and stuff, it's for the most part, it's older, an older crowd, right? Anywhere from you have your, like, you know, 10 to 13-year-old kids that play games also. But MineCon was really more focused on a younger crowd. So I was able
right.
to see, like, more than anything, the attention span of you know, younger kids like that and how willing they were to play the game. And, yeah, my jaw just dropped at, yeah, the amount of time that people were willing to play the game at an event like that.
So,
yeah, outside of that, yeah.
So, and how did MineCon come about? I mean, how did that get on your radar, so to speak?
Yeah, so MineCon was actually kind of just luck. It was pure luck. I was actually scheduled to be at TwitchCon, which was a week, was it? Yeah, it was about a week after MineCon. And John Polson, who's a really, really cool guy, supports, like, the indie scene tremendously, just posted on Twitter one day, hey, if you guys are going to be at TwitchCon, I have openings at MineCon the week before. So if you're going to be in the area, you know, TwitchCon was San Diego and MineCon was Anaheim. He just posted on Twitter, if you guys are going to be in the area, you know, let me know and maybe we could get you guys to show your games at MineCon because we're doing this indie booth space or whatever. And I, you know, I sent him a build of the game, and luckily I was one of the games that they chose. Of the, I want to say, 15 games that they were able to screen. So that was awesome.
Mm.
But, yeah, it was definitely just, I was on Twitter one day just checking stuff. And
there you go.
That
so
was
do
it.
You find,
yeah, that was it.
Do you find that social media is a good resource? You know, we talked earlier, you mentioned earlier about asking questions, getting out there, asking questions of other people, of, you know, people that you might meet. Do you use social media to communicate with others in your industry and the video game space?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I exclusively use, you know, Twitter and Facebook just for that. Otherwise, I would have no other reason to. And, yeah, they're super useful. Like, if it wasn't for Twitter, I wouldn't have heard of the TwitchCon thing. Or the TwitchCon, sorry, the MineCon thing.
Right.
And by doing that, you also get to find out of other events. But more than anything, if there's anyone listening who's interested in knowing about these events, if you're a developer wanting to get into these events, you can go to promoterapp.com, and that is a 100,000% useful resource to find out about deadlines and for these events, like for you to submit your games to these events and stuff like that. So that's definitely something that has helped me keep track of deadlines and new events that are popping up. And it's not just here in the States. It's events all over the world. It's actually a website that was created by my buddy Andreas Zeltner, who worked on another game called Future Unfolding. You know, he's the one who put that together.
And what is
awesome.
That again?
It is promoterapp.com.
Okay.
At promoterapp.com/calendar. Yeah, the calendar will take you directly to all the deadlines of events and stuff. But Promoter App itself is a way for you to keep track of like mentions and reviews and a way for you to give out codes to like media and stuff like that. It's a really useful tool. And if you go to the website, you know, you can find out information on that. And it's really cheap to subscribe to it. It's free to use. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. Continue, please.
No, it's okay. I was just going to say it's free to use, but if you do pay the subscription fee, which I'm not mistaken is $10 a month, there's other things you can do with it. But yeah, so the calendar is absolutely free. Like you just go and you read it and, you know, you click on the submit the events and you can submit to those events. Pretty cool. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Peter.
No, that's fine. But talking about your use of social media, since you do use social media for that purpose,
yeah,
let's take a moment to have you tell the listeners, tell those tuning into Gaming Chords, how do they find you? How do they keep up to date with you on Twitter and Facebook? Where can they find information about you and the game?
Sure. For me and the game, you could just go to Ask an Enemy on Twitter. I have three Twitter accounts, but they're all for different things. It's my personal account, my Ask an Enemy Studios is Ask an Enemy. And Facebook is basically facebook.com/AskAnEnemyStudios. And then Ask an Enemy Studios, the website as well, .com.
Is Ask an Enemy Studios your studio company?
Yes.
Great. I love the name. Hey, we do have a – we have a question that has come into us. Someone who's not wanting to ask it live, but that's fine. The question is, and let me pull it up here.
Sure.
What made you inspired to create the type of game you made? What was it that inspired you to create this type of game? What was the inspiration?
So the type of game, I don't really know how to answer that outside of just, I just wanted to make something fun that I would want to play. Again, I just applied the logic I did to when I write music. I wanted to write music I want to listen to. With the game, I just wanted to make a game I wanted to play based on games that I like to play. And, you know, I don't know if you've caught on to this at all, but the acronym of the game is ADHD. If you've ever played the game, you'll understand why is your attention is really tested. So I just wanted to make something you can jump into and play. There are a lot of games that you kind of jump into. You want to jump in and just kind of, you know, shoot some stuff or blow some stuff up and, and play the game. But so many games nowadays, you jump in, you have to go through 15 minutes of exposition or, you know, some kind of setup. And it's like, I just wanted to make a game that harkened back to the type of games I liked to play when I was a kid and just score-based, fun, blow some stuff up and have some fun, and you're done, you're out. So it was the idea of just something really quick. Yeah. I hope that answers the question, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, as a side note, though, I mean, and you mentioned a few games in our discussion here, but what were some of the games that you played growing up that you did enjoy so much? What were some of the titles, your favorite game titles?
Well, by far, 100%, my favorite game of all time is the Metal Gear series. Those games are awesome, and that's really weird to think because, you know, a lot of those have a lot, like, there's a game in the Metal Gear series that has an hour and a half long cutscene, you know? But it's just, it's the idea of the mechanics that, like, Hideo Kojima puts into the game. So it's games like Metal Gear that have mechanics that are just really interesting and break the fourth wall. But then also going back to when I was a kid, it was games like, you know, that just kind of threw you in and had you, like, experiment and test things. For example, like Super Mario World, there's no tutorial in Super Mario World. It just drops you in and you pick up a leaf that lets you fly all of a sudden. And now because you're able to fly, you can go to parts of the level that you never even knew were there. And if you never picked up the leaf that lets you fly, you would just go through the level and never even see that whole other part of the game that existed, you know? There are a lot of games that don't do that anymore. And that's, it's kind of sad, but, you know, everyone makes the games they want to make. So luckily there are a lot of indie developers now that are kind of, you know, kind of going more towards that. But yeah, it was games like that, like Super Mario World, R-Type, UN Squadron. UN Squadron was like a roguelike that had roguelike elements in it before people even knew what roguelikes were. You know, you would play this game where you were this ship that would just go around bombing stuff, and when you die, you're like, okay, well, what was that whole point? And then you realize all that money that you were earning, you now have to upgrade your ship or buy a new ship, buy new weapons. And, yeah, just UN Squadron blew my mind when I was a kid because of stuff like that. Like, and it never, ever taught you that. It didn't tell you by beating you over the head with some kind of tutorial that, you know, hey, when you die, you're going to have all this money that you can now use to upgrade your ship. You know, you just did it by dying, and you're like, holy crap, okay, now I can, you know, it just created this loop that just got you sucked into the gameplay, and it was awesome.
So a few questions. Let's a few short questions that we'll try to knock out some answers here. So somebody starting out, we mentioned Game Maker and Unity. One or the other, which would you suggest people start with?
Unreal Engine is also another one. Unreal Engine is more visual scripting, so it uses something called Blueprint, which lets you kind of visualize how you control things. So it's more about connecting things with visual lines and stuff like that. I'm not 100% familiar with how it actually works outside of just knowing that that's, you know, on a surface level how it works. You just connect a bunch of stuff without actually having to write much code. Trying to think of... Yeah, those are the three, really, is Game Maker, Unity, and Unreal. And they all have... The reason I went with Unity is Unity has a really good... community. So a lot more people are using Unity, which means obviously there's a lot more people running into issues that you probably have. Where Unreal, maybe by now there's obviously a more supportive community with Unreal, but Unity was the way I went because they have really good tutorials on their website. So you could go to learn.unity3d.com, and all of those tutorials are the exact same tutorials I use to learn. And then if I had a question on C-sharp scripting, which is what I ended up going with, Unity also lets you use JavaScript. If you're familiar with JavaScript, then holy shit, like just go and do that because now you can use your JavaScript, you know, expertise or whatever and use it to make a game in Unity. Game Maker uses their own proprietary language. So But there's still some really good tutorials online for GameMaker also. Tom Francis, as a matter of fact, I always mention this at my panels. Tom Francis had some really good GameMaker tutorials that you can learn from as well. If you go on YouTube and just look up Tom Francis, he created a game called Gunpoint. Yeah.
That actually was leading to the next question, is one or two people that you'd recommend people follow or that they should be aware of, other than yourself, in the indie game development community. Tom Francis, you said?
Yeah, Tom Francis.
Anyone else?
If you don't mind me pointing out two more people, Mike Geig and Adam Buckner. Those two guys work at Unity, and they're the ones that have the Unity tutorial that I particularly used. But yeah, Mike Geig, G-E-I-G, sorry, and Adam Buckner. You could find those guys on Twitter also. I don't have their Twitter handles.
Sure, they can. Yeah. Our listeners will be able to find it. Where do
Google.
You see the
Definitely.
gaming going in the next couple of years? Future projections, would you say? Because we have virtual reality platforms coming out that seem to be left and right. Every time you go to Best Buy, there's a new platform. There's the Oculus Rift, of course, the HTC Vive, augmented reality that was made popular by Pokemon Go, particularly. Mobile games, obviously, has been around for a while. But where do you see, if you had a prediction of where you thought the game development community was going or the gaming industry, any insights from you?
Not really, man. I mean, because I kind of just go with the flow also. Like, I mean, obviously you do see all that VR stuff coming in. And, like, Sony has a really good hold on the VR market. If they could just do something about the tech, the tech, I think, is their Achilles heel. I recently just picked up a PSVR, and I also have a Vive because I want to experiment with, you know, looking at that kind of stuff also, where the Vive has the fidelity, the PlayStation VR has the audience, if that makes sense.
Right, sure.
Yeah, and they need to find that middle ground there. That if they just latch onto and they make it work, like, I think VR could be really, really big. I could probably see it going that way if just Sony does something about the tech and being able to make it less buggy, because the ability to just pick up a headset and put it on and have it work is a million times more useful than it is on PC, where putting a Vive on, like, sometimes the controllers don't sync, or you have some kind of display issue because your video card isn't pushing to the headset correctly. And on the PSVR, like, I've had maybe one out of five times the system doesn't work. On the Vive, I would say maybe four out of five times the system doesn't work. But yeah, I could see VR being really, really big, and AR if even Microsoft did the thing with their, you know, headset with the Scorpio, that might even be something that works, but we'll have to find that out at E3, right? Because that's when they're going to.
Absolutely, which is coming up. Yeah. E3 is coming up shortly here. And talking about coming up, we're about out of time here, but JC, is there anything that we haven't hit on that you'd like to talk about or get across to our listeners, those on gaming cords? Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd want to make sure we hit upon?
No, I mean, everything kind of tangentially just relates, I guess. Like, one of the things I do a lot is I do these panels at, like, PAX, when I'm lucky enough to be chosen to do them, of course, right? But I do a panel called Make Games, Not Excuses. And I would just like that if people are listening and they want to make games, make them. Don't just think about it. Don't just talk about it. Do it. Like, there's nothing that's stopping you. A lot of these tools that are out there, like Unity, Unreal, GameMaker, they all have free versions where you can just pick it up and tinker with it. And don't be afraid, if school is not your thing, don't be afraid to not do that. But also, you know, just weigh out your options. Like, why would you want to go to school? Why would you not want to go to school? That's really it. And, it obviously has a bigger impact in terms of, it's not just about school or whatever, just always ask questions about what you want to do and do it to the best of your ability. Like, that's the only thing I can think of, really.
Well, I think that's a perfect note on which to end this episode of Gaming Chords. JC Salinas of Ask an Enemy Studios and a Dual Hand Disaster Tracker, I really appreciate the time that you took to spend with me talking about games, talking about the gaming industry, about the indie game development, and we'll look forward to the release of your game coming up in 2017. Again, a Dual Hand Disaster Tracker. And again, just for those that are listening, if they want to follow you on Twitter, what's that Twitter handle again?
Ask an Enemy. It's all
Ask
one word.
Ask an Enemy. Thank you so much, JC. Have a great night.
Absolutely. Thank you, man.
Ready to make fashion fireworks? Right now at Old Navy, get up to 60% off the entire store during Old Navy's red, white, and new sale. Save big with items for $2, $4, $6, and $8, including women's tanks for just $2. And up to 60% off summer essentials like flip-flops, tank tops, swimwear, and shorts. Get more bang for your buck with up to 60% off your favorite all-American styles right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Select styles only. Entire store offer valid 6/28 to 7/5. Excludes clearance, gift cards, register lane items, jewelry, today only deals, 2-day only deals. Ready to make fashion fireworks? Right now at Old Navy, get up to 60% off the entire store during Old Navy's red, white, and new sale. Save big with items for $2, $4, $6, and $8, including women's tanks for just $2. And up to 60% off summer essentials like flip-flops, tank tops, swimwear, and shorts. Get more bang for your buck with up to 60% off your favorite all-American styles right now at Old Navy and OldNavy.com. Select styles only. Entire store offer valid 6/28 to 7/5. Excludes clearance, gift cards, register lane items, jewelry, today only deals, 2-day only deals.